Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. Ben Swanson, your host, with you again today. And today we are joined by a very special guest. That is our new director of analytics, Mitch Tanney. A new position in a growing field. Analytics have kind of come on pretty strong recently. Obviously, they've been around in baseball for a while, made pretty popular with the movie about the
Moneyball.
Athletics. Yeah, yeah. Obviously, it's been around for a lot longer than before the movie came out. Now, as far as football analytics go, I don't have any experience. I come from a basketball background where everything's quantified. Assists, steals, pretty much anything you need to know about basketball, there's a lot of statistics behind it, and there's so many games, you have a big sample size. So I guess what I kind of want to know is, what do football analytics do? I mean, obviously, there's not as big sample size, and you know, I don't know how you kind of quantify what offensive linemen do.
Yeah, so first and foremost, thanks for having me, and you know, I'm excited to be here and looking forward to working with the organization. In terms of football analytics and how it differs a little bit from some of the other sports, one of the biggest differences is the dependent relationships. So when you have 11 guys on the field and on a side, you're talking about 11-on-11 versus essentially one-on-one in baseball, you know, a pitcher and a batter, and 5-on-5 in basketball. So it makes things a little more complicated from an analytics perspective, but there's still information and insights that can be extracted from the data. And that's really what I'm trying to do, is be able to extract information that can provide insight to the coaches, provide insight to personnel, and ideally help us make more informed decisions.
Now, as a good journalism student undergrad, I gave up on math after my first statistics class my first semester. What was your path like? You played at Monmouth in New Jersey, I think.
It's actually Monmouth College in Monmouth, Illinois.
Oh, so okay.
In different Illinois. Monmouth, okay. That's all right.
Gotcha. So you played football there.
I did.
And you had a degree in math and I think psychology.
Spanish.
Okay. All right. I'm getting
Let's keep it in English,
wires.
Though.
Yeah. My Spanish also not so great. And then you went on and you got your master's at Iowa.
I did.
What was the path to kind of get into analytics? It's obviously something that not a lot of people are still kind of feeling out at this point.
Yeah, so I think what really kind of led me in that path was a lot of the upper-level math classes from my undergraduate work. It was more proof and more theory-based. So it was primarily focused on showing why things work in some of the lower-level math courses. And to me, that wasn't the best fit. I was more interested in how I could apply some of the statistical methods and some of the logic that I was learning in some of those courses. And then really, I was very fortunate. I had a great experience at the University of Iowa. One of my professors there actually conducts his research in sports analytics. And I completed his course. It was a data and decisions course. And from that moment on, I was, with my football background and being able to combine it with statistics, I was really geared toward, hey, I think there's something I can do professionally, and combining those two fields. And that since then, I was really fortunate. I had an independent study with that professor. Jeff Ullman is his name, and he's been a great resource even since I've graduated, and been able to combine really two passions of mine, which is football and numerical analysis.
Now, was the position with the Bears previously that you held, was that your first one with like an NFL team?
It was. That was my first job in the NFL, and it really led. It came about as a result of my interactions with the Bears while I was employed by Stats. So I was in a product management role and an analytics-based role with Stats, which is based just in the northern suburbs of Chicago. So I was able to interact with a number of different NFL teams, and the Bears were obviously close, and one thing led to the next, and I was very fortunate to have a position.
How was it with the Bears? I mean, I think they have kind of like a growing reputation as a team that's embraced advanced statistics. What did you take away from your time with them?
I think more than anything, I just feel really fortunate I was able to have a job in the NFL. And, you know, there's 32 NFL franchises, and I think maybe roughly half or a little more than half now have analytics positions. And I think that number is going to continue to grow. And I think more than anything, it's being able to interact with front office personnel, with coaches, and being able to try to take something that's complex and try to make it more applicable so that it can be applied in a practice setting, a game setting.
So for you in the off season, what have you been kind of doing? I mean, I don't want to go too deep in here, but can you give me like a little overview of what your day-to-day is kind of like?
Yeah, without getting too much into the details, I think you know, my kind of standard response is trying to help us win. So as vague as that is. But, you know, taking a look at historical trends around the league, what certain teams are doing, what we've done from a self-scouting perspective, and then, you know, also on the personnel side, trying to assist with the draft and college free agency shortly thereafter.
So you've been going to Sloan, is that right?
I have.
Sports Analytics Conference up in Massachusetts. Was there anything interesting that you took away from this year? I kind of looked through the panels a little bit. I didn't see a whole lot on American football as much as some other sports.
I think more than anything, what I've really benefited from attending that conference is some of the research. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's PhD students, graduate level, you know, master's students, or just people in professional fields outside of sports that are conducting their research. They, you know, they conduct research in sports. It's a passion for them, and they want to try to learn more and investigate new things. And I really benefit just from listening to those presentations. I think there's some great ideas. And, you know, you try to come back, and once you get back to your desk, see if what can be applied.
And I think there's a bit of a misconception about analytics. I think a lot of the backlash that some people have, you know, people who say, oh, like, you got to have the eye test, and, you know, all these guys are just relying on numbers. They don't see the game. But there's got to be I think there's a lot more people who don't do that and who embrace analytics, and they're just taking in that as another valuable piece of information that you can add to
the that's exactly right. Yeah. It's just another piece of the puzzle. Traditional scouting, obviously there's a vast amount of work that goes into scouting a player, and analytics is just one piece of that. And ideally, when the subjective meets the objective, that's when you feel most confident going into the decision-making process. And really, it's just you're trying to add more information, try to look at things maybe from a different perspective, use a different lens, and be able to have those conversations.
And one of my favorite pieces from Sloan, one of my friends wrote up a little story on on one of the research papers that was presented at Sloan. It was about basketball and when you should foul as the game goes down. And, like, I guess one of the conclusions is that if you're a team that's leading, you should be fouling. It's just kind of funny. Like, sometimes you don't even think about it. And, you know, even though this is something they probably don't intend to be implemented, it's kind of interesting to see that, you know, you might improve your winning chances if you start making the game even uglier.
Yeah, and there are some things in all the sports that maybe are a little counterintuitive to, mm-hmm. You know, the conventional wisdom, so to speak. And, you know, for instance, you look in the NBA, the mid-range jump shot has slowly disappeared.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of that's been a result of the analytics work that teams have done and, you know, trying to find the most value on the floor, and the most value on the floor is either at the rim or behind the three-point line. So, mm-hmm. you know, that'd be one example where I think analytics has really taken hold in a sport.
Oh, for sure. And it's a growing in all of these sports. I think football is catching up. Obviously, baseball ahead of the curve. Basketball has really invested heavily in not only, like, analysis of statistics, but they're starting to use, like, positional, where they keep track of where the players are going on the court. And they've kind of made this available to fans. If you go to their website and you go to, say, a box score on their stats site, you can click on, like, a certain play, and you can see, you know, they have the players number 1 through 5. And for both teams, you can see how it kind of shapes up on, like, a scoring play or a block or whatever. Have you seen, like, tracking, player tracking, I guess, becoming part of football? Like, on a running play, I can see that kind of being very valuable, as how a group of 5 guys or 6 guys, you know, control a line as they prepare to open up holes.
Yeah, I think the NFL is definitely moving that way with Zebra Technologies, who was, I believe they were in either 17 or 19 stadiums last year, and using a different technology, but essentially a player tracking technology. And the amount of data that will be accessible to teams is going to grow exponentially once that data becomes available. You're talking about 11-on-11 player tracking. That's a vast amount of data.
Mm-hmm. And that's certainly something that will be very interesting to see how that helps the sport grow. Mitch, I want to thank you for your time today. It's been a lot of fun learning more about this, something I didn't have a whole lot of experience with as far as from the football aspect. But I appreciate it, and I hope this goes well as you enter, you know, further months of getting into the Denver Broncos culture, getting into the organization, and helping out the front office make a lot of their decisions.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, and after the break, we'll have Andrew Mason on to talk a little bit about the draft. All right, thanks for staying with us after the break. I've got our independent analyst, Andrew Mason, here with us. We're going to talk a little bit about the draft and some of the mock drafts and who they're forecasting. But first, we just got the Broncos preseason schedule out. On Thursday, we got Seattle, again, week one, again, of the preseason. The date isn't exact, just have a range at this point, August 13th through 17th.
But you hope it's the 13th, and you hope it's the 13th because the start of training camp is going to likely be based around the first preseason game, because you cannot have your first practice until 2 weeks before your preseason opener. So, you know, that's one reason why teams more and more have been going to these Thursday night games, because relative to, say, a Saturday night preseason opener, that gets you two extra days of practice. So as a result of that, you know, hopefully it'll be a Thursday night game. I actually went and checked the Seattle Mariners schedule. Their last game before going on a road trip is that Wednesday, so I would presume that the facility, CenturyLink Field, will be available, so it wouldn't surprise me if it's a Thursday the 13th, and the Broncos start training camp 2 weeks before that.
Perfect time of the year, especially to go to Seattle. That'll be awesome. Now, on the flip side of that, going to Houston in August, not so much fun.
But they have a roof. The Texans have a roof on the stadium, so won't be too bad. Although, in past years, you know, that they met in five of six preseasons from 03 to 08. And in two of those preseasons, going down to Houston, the Broncos actually did joint practices with the Texans. Those were the years before Gary Kubiak became their head coach in 2006. It was when Dom Capers was with the Texans at the time. So, you know, that, I can tell you, although the game was fine because they closed the roof, those practices outside those years were brutal. So, we'll see what happens. We'll see what the Broncos do, whether there are some joint practices. But, I think for the sake of all of us, hopefully there won't be more than a couple of days in Houston just around the game.
Yeah, one of our PR guys just came over from Houston from the Texans. Mm-hmm. And Phil from our video side was saying, asking him about how they do practices there. And he was like, oh, outside.
It's amazingly unpleasant. And I spent a good portion of my youth and college years on the Gulf Coast in Tampa. I think it gets hotter and more humid and more miserable the farther west you go along the Gulf Coast among the cities. So that would mean that New Orleans had more oppressive summertime weather than Tampa, and then Houston was the worst of all, because in Houston you'll have the heat and the humidity. You're not too far from the water, but you're just far enough inland to where you don't get that sea breeze that you would sit down in Galveston, and the temperature will hit 100 degrees sometimes. It's an awful place to practice. I mean, you know, it toughens you up, I suppose, but sometimes you can, and this is why some teams in the past from the deep south would go north to Wisconsin back in the day. You'd have, you know, Jacksonville used to go do some training camp in Wisconsin, and the Saints used to do that. Now that the Saints actually go up to West Virginia to White Sulphur Springs to avoid that kind of climate, but the Texans think it toughens them up.
Well, maybe so. These are teams that are very familiar with each other. Obviously, mm-hmm. The Broncos hosted the Texans coming in last summer for some practices, joint practices before they played.
Very intense ones.
Yes. But even further than that, I mean, obviously the Seahawks, they played them twice last year between the preseason and regular season. Mm-hmm. 49ers, their most common opponent in preseason matches all time. Mm-hmm. This will be the 37th meeting. They will be the Broncos' first home game of the preseason, week three. They'll take on a very different-looking 49ers. I'm not sure many people are going to know what that team's going to look like at all.
Well, you'd think you'd know the quarterback. I mean, you assume at this point it's going to be Colin Kaepernick. But without Patrick Willis on the defense, you know, the scheme will be the same with Jim Tomsula, a former defensive assistant there, now the head coach. But certainly, it's a team in some state of transition. It'll be interesting to see what they look like when they come out here. Last year, also, that third preseason week was when the Broncos had joint practices with the Houston Texans when they came here. So it would seem logical, and it would be no surprise if that is when the Broncos have joint practices again. You know, the 49ers aren't on the regular season schedule. It might be a good fit for both teams to get some extra prep work.
And one of the benefits there of the new facility, the indoor facilities, there is an extra set of locker rooms in there.
Yes.
So if a team were to visit, they could use those locker rooms. It makes it a lot more hospitable for teams coming in, just a lot easier than, say, just running a bunch of buses out.
Not just a locker room, but also you've got training room. I mean, you got your hot tub, you got your cold tub, you've got everything you need to do as far as preparing for practice, you know, before, during, and after. A team is able to do over in that new field house. There's even locker rooms for all the coaches. So, you know, one of the big problems with joint practices for teams over the years at a lot of venues is that they have to get dressed and do everything at the hotel, then get on the bus, go to the facility, and then get back on the bus, and everyone's all, you know, sweaty and stinky and all that. So that won't be the case now, and with the Broncos' new facility and teams, you know, I'm not going to say teams are going to fall all over themselves to get to Denver for joint practices, but it's going to be a very attractive situation.
And to wrap things up in the preseason, the Broncos will host the Cardinals. They also played the Cardinals in the regular season last year, where they had a torching game. Mm-hmm. Demaryius Thomas had the single game receiving yards record, 226. Peyton Manning had his most passing yards of his career. The offense had their most total yards, net yards, franchise history by 1 yard.
Against a very tough Cardinal defense, although with Calais Campbell getting hurt,
yeah,
you know, during that game, that certainly had an impact when he went down in the third quarter. But the Broncos were moving the football well even before then. Also, the game where the pass rush really got going and ended up knocking Drew Stanton out of the game, and he had to give way to Logan Thomas, who had one brilliant throw, beating the coverage of Nate Irving, but aside from that, struggled and was under duress most of the time. Cardinals, of course, another frequent Broncos preseason opponent. In fact, if you go through the last 12 preseasons, including the one that we're about to have this year, they've met in 10 of those. They've met 12 times in the preseason overall since 2000. Proximity has a lot to do with that. That's one of the reasons why they meet in the preseason finale. In fact, the preseason finale is the one that teams kind of schedule themselves, whereas the league sets the rest of the preseason games. So, Arizona-Denver, it's been a logical matchup to close the preseason for both sides. It's a 602-mile flight from DIA to Sky Harbor Airport in Phoenix. And, so once again, Cardinals visiting. And, of course, the last preseason game, so probably won't see the starters.
Right.
I've long advocated that to increase the in-house attendance, they need to have a cool giveaway, maybe a bobblehead of some kind.
Yeah.
My proposal is the joint Peyton Manning, Frank Trepuka, number 18 bobblehead, but I don't think that's going to happen. That's just my crazy idea.
Like half down the middle?
Or like two of them. Cause
two
I,
of them, okay.
Yeah, like two bobbleheads.
Like
two.
A Frankenstein.
No. It's like two bobbleheads on one. I've actually got one from an Atlanta Braves game that is Sid Bream sliding into home plate in the 92 NLCS, and it's Bream and Michael Valier and the umpire, so it's three. But I'm just saying, just have the two 18s on there. I think that would be cool, but it's not my money that would be spent on the promotion. But I do think that if you had a cool promotion, it might compel people to come down for the game, because unfortunately that last preseason game usually has a pretty high no-show count because you don't see the starters.
That's funny you mentioned that using your own money to fund a promotion. There's a story that our own Jim Sacamano, former PR director here, he wrote a little story for us about back in 1971, there was an enterprising entrepreneur and fan of the Broncos. Team wasn't doing so well, and fans were getting really frustrated. So this guy, out of his own pocket, he approved it by the Broncos first, but he just started getting all this orange fabric, giving fans just a slice of orange to get at the game when they get there and wave it during the game.
Yep, the inimitable Charlie Goldberg, who actually he wrote a book about his years as a Bronco fan. And it's interesting to look back at Broncos history in the 1960s and the early 1970s. you know, there were a couple of drives in terms of season tickets or, you know, raising some money that really helped keep the team in Denver. One, you know, that got a lot of tickets sold, and another was not just tickets, but also making sure that there was money to fund the expansion of Mile High Stadium after a bond issue got voted down by local voters in the late 1960s. So, you know, it's, you know, you go back to that era of Broncos history, and you can see, you know, the fans really put their money where their support was to help keep the team here. And certainly, you know, you look, I'm not sure it was really about foresight at the time. I think they just, you know, wanted to make sure that Denver was still major league in some way. But now, I mean, you look back and, you know, go to the mid 60s, late 60s, and they were, at one point, this team was close to moving, you know, perhaps to Atlanta was one proposed destination before the Falcons came into being. But the fans and the local business community in particular stepped up and saved it. And Charlie Goldberg was involved in a lot of these and a lot of these movements, first to save the team and then to help build the support like he did with Orange Sunday. Just a great idea. And, you know, we don't see the orange pieces of cloth anymore, but now it seems like pretty much every game, or at least certainly the warm weather games when everyone has their jerseys on and not jackets, is Orange Sunday.
Now, I don't know how to transition away from this right now, but to talk about the draft a little bit, we're getting pretty close here. I think we're about 3 weeks away. I've been keeping tabs, I would say, of the mock drafts, you know, the bigger ones, I guess. It's kind of hard to put out all the feelers. But I've got CBS, I've got NFL.com, SB Nation, I got one from them in there. Got a rep back to them. And for a while, you know, obviously ESPN, yeah, I forgot about them. For a while, it was kind of varied. You know, offensive line was one that was pretty common, but there were inside linebackers, there were nose tackles, defensive tackles, tight ends. There were a fair amount of positions involved. And then as the increasingly analysts have just completely gone full in on the Broncos going offensive line with their first round pick. It's not completely surprising. Orlando Franklin is out. He went to San Diego. They signed Shelly Smith, and they traded for Gino Gradkowski, but that's it so far.
That's it, and Gradkowski's in the last year of his deal, of his first contract that he initially got from the Baltimore Ravens. Shelly Smith, you know, kind of an up and down career at this point. You know, these are guys that they have experience, but they're not proven commodities. What is interesting is how many of those mock drafts kind of focused on offensive tackle in particular. You know, when, you know, the Broncos seem to be high on Michael Schofield at right tackle. That being said, Schofield does have the ability to go inside to left guard and be in the mix there. Now, T.J. Clemmings, a bunch of the mock drafts have Denver taking him. I think he's a very good scheme fit for what the Broncos want to do. He's got the footwork, he's got the quickness, he's got the long arms that you want in a zone blocking offensive tackle. But really, what's interesting is that Gary Kubiak and Rick Dennison have had a lot of success over the years with late second, third day picks, as the draft is constituted now, with the third round being on the second day and rounds 4 through 7 on the third, and then undrafted guys, and then kind of sitting, having them learn for a year on the bench, and then put them in. So I don't think it's really a slam dunk that the Broncos go in that direction. I think Pat Kerwin was the contrarian, to use a word that we've thrown around often in the last 25 minutes or so before he went on the air. Kerwin suggested the Broncos would take Jordan Phillips, a nose tackle from out of Oklahoma, 6'5", 329. And he's right on that. He's right on that border between the first and the second round. He might be a good fit. Another guy that.
Hold on a sec. A little disclaimer. He hasn't. I don't think he's updated his since February 24th, though.
Okay. All right.
Still.
So.
Go on.
Anyway. So.
He's still no. Phillips is still a very talented
player. He's a talented
player in that range.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, if Malcolm Brown from Texas drops, I think he's actually the best scheme fit if the Broncos went for a nose tackle for the Wade Phillips defense. Mm-hmm. So, thus, when you're talking about nose tackles for Wade Phillips, you're not talking about the guys that are 340, 350. You're talking about the guys that are 320. That would rule out a guy like Danny Shelton who, you know, if you had a big, if you're looking for a big gap-clogging, blocker-occupying, you know, immobile piece in the middle, Danny Shelton would be your guy. He's out of the University of Washington, but I don't think Shelton is necessarily a good scheme fit. Whereas Malcolm Brown, Jordan Phillips, even a Carl Davis out of Iowa, those guys project better to being nose tackles in Wade Phillips' defense. And really, the fact everyone's zeroed in on the offensive line, but right now, the Broncos, as their roster is constituted, at least have an experienced option everywhere along the offensive line. You know, if you've let's say that Schofield, you put him in at right tackle, he doesn't work out. You still have Chris Clark, who started last year and the start of the season, and Kubiak made a point at the league meetings of saying, hey, don't forget about him. The slate's clean. We know he struggled last year before he got benched, but he's going to have another chance to push for the job. At left guard, you know, you've got Shelly Smith, who started in the league, who the Broncos picked up. And then at center, you not only have Gino Gradkowski, who started for the Ravens all through 2013, and obviously Kubiak and Dennison think something of him if they're willing to make a trade to bring him in. They saw his work on the practice field from day to day, even though he didn't play all that much last year. They saw him develop, and they obviously liked something in the way he developed, like him enough to bring him in. And then you got Manny Ramirez, who could also be in the mix, who has started center for this team before, although you can question whether he's a good scheme fit or not in terms of the quickness that you have to have as a zone blocking center. So, they've got experience. They don't have to pick an offensive lineman in the first round to be an immediate starter. Last year, it kind of worked out for them in that the position where they had the most immediate need was also the one that had arguably the best player on the board when the Broncos picked. That was Bradley Roby. They weren't expecting him to be there when pick number 31 came up in the first round last year, and that was a need at that point because you had Chris Harris coming off ACL and the ACL injury. You didn't know how well he was going to respond to that. We hadn't even gotten to OTAs when he really started kind of to run and sprint and kind of and test his test the recovery and the strength of that knee. So adding Roby was essential for, at minimum, you know, using him as a third cornerback, in case Chris Harris wasn't healthy, you could have had Tlaib, Kayvon Webster, and Bradley Roby, or even as a starting cornerback if Harris had not come back from the ACL. Then beyond that, once Harris was healthy, you needed a number three cornerback, and that's what the role that Bradley Roby ended up filling. So that was the rare instance of where your one pressing need and the best player available lined up. You look at the Broncos right now, I think they're pretty comfortable with a starting lineup that they can put out there at this point. There's no obvious need. So they have the freedom to select the best player available. So I don't think it's a slam dunk they take offensive line. Shoot, they may even take quarterback, for all we know. That's not out of the question. It's a little more wide open than people are forecasting right now, I think, when the people that do the mock drafts.
Well, we'll see how this goes. Obviously, with mock drafts, everything changes from week to week, more or less. I don't think you'll ever get a consensus. It's very rare, except for maybe the first pick sometimes.
And even then, there seems to be a little wavering right now.
Yes, so we'll keep you updated on what analysts think will shake out for the Broncos as this goes on. I saw one mock draft. You know, SB Nation has all those, they have their network of blogs, mm-hmm. and so they did a mock draft where they have, you know, the people who run the blogs pick for their team. And so in this, how this picked out, it didn't really shape up how a lot of mock drafts do. So in this mock draft, the Broncos picked Eric Armstead out of Oregon, a pass rusher who people don't really see as a particular need of the Broncos.
When did they make that pick? That's what I'd like to know.
April 3rd. That might have been before.
Before, okay. So we're talking about, well, it was actually right after the Antonio Smith announcement. But that is, you know, if you think he's the best player available, great. And again, the Broncos do have the freedom to take the best player available if that's the way they see fit, and not think too much about a specific position. That being said, Eric Armstead is your classic 3-5 technique defensive end in a 3-4. Now, I think he's got a steep learning curve. I mean, there's the production at Oregon, in my opinion, wasn't where you want it to be, and that's kind of the big hole in the evaluation right now is why wasn't he, you know, he can rush the passer, but why wasn't he able to convert more of those into sacks, and why was his pressure inconsistent at times? But he's got all the athletic tools, and maybe if the Broncos did take a guy like Armstead, you know, he could afford to sit on the bench and learn and refine his game and be ready to contribute a lot in year two. But yeah, I don't see that pick as the best use of the selection. That mock pick.
They might have made it like the day before,
right?
And it didn't get posted.
Because right now, you've got Malik Jackson, Derek Wolfe as your starting two ends, and then Vance Walker and Antonio Smith. You haven't made a lot of free agency investments from the outside, but those are, you know, two of the key ones. And you've got your four-man rotation, which is what Bill Kolar wants, and certainly we know how he feels about Antonio Smith, and we know how Antonio Smith feels about him from his comments on the conference call earlier this week. There's definitely a good mutual relationship there, and I think Smith's going to be very valuable, especially in the pass rush.
Well, that'll wrap it up for our podcast. I want to thank both Mace and our Director of Analytics, Mitch Tanning, for joining us earlier. Hoping to get up to more guests on the podcast this season. We should be able to. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes or listen on the site. I'm your host, Ben Swanson. And
I'm Andrew Mason, and thanks for joining us.